Good afternoon. The House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Today we are going to be focusing on sort of the broad topic of school safety and security. And, you know, the committee is really going to be looking at a broad range of options that focus on one core premise, and that is giving schools the options that they need to meet the needs of their students. The measures moving forward that we're going to talk about today and probably others in the future are to be informed by various stakeholders with our students' best interests at heart. And those stakeholders are broad and encompassing our school boards, administrators, teachers, parents, the community at large, and we are anxious to hear from all of you on this important topic. I don't believe that the solution is a single program or a single line item of funding, but we're going to rely on a variety of complementary provisions to include but not be limited to supporting the needs of our students and upgrading our facilities. So with that, before we turn to we're going to offer a couple of bills and hear quick testimony on those that will kind of set the stage, I think, for some of the rest of the testimony that we'll hear today. But first, we need to take care of a little housekeeping and move the minutes from our last meeting. Representative Crescia, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Madam Chair, I've read the minutes, and I will move the minutes.
All right. So Representative Crescia moves adoption of the March 1st minutes. Any questions? All right, seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Crescia. All right, so first, we've kind of got bills that are not quite in the same topic area, but we had two days of really, I think, terrific testimony on mental health needs of our students in our schools and what programs we have available and where we maybe still are needing to improve or increase access last week. And so, Representative Anselmo, I wanted to lead off today by hearing your bill, and it has to do with suicide prevention. And this is kind of keys off of sort of legislation already in law with regards to teachers having some training and professional development on that. So, Representative Anselmo, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, and if you want to move your bill, we will be laying it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dario Anselmo, and I'm going to be introducing a bill, House File 3167, which is a suicide prevention training bill. As some of you know, my interest in mental health goes back 25 years. My father suffered from and survived bipolar illness, and our family had to deal with it for all of his life, and it was a challenge. I served on the Mental Health Association Board, was a president of the Bipolar Support Alliance, and worked with a number of mental health organizations across the state, including NAMI, which we'll get to later, and SAVE, which deals with suicide prevention and education. I'm happy to finally get to do a bill on mental health and education, which are two areas of interest and passion. I'll go through a couple talking points quickly, and then I'm going to introduce someone to kind of go through the details of the bill as quickly as possible. Suicide, as many people know, is the second leading cause of death for people between the ages of 10 and 17. It's awful. It's tragic. A number of youth have mental illness and persistent mental illnesses, and the schools are really a place that we need to identify these things and find a way to seek treatment. In this case, we're looking to sort of find a way to fund a program we've already sort of initiated with Cognito, and we'll talk more about that. This is something that's personal for many people in our community. A family, close friends of ours, lost their son to depression and suicide. And it's something that if it would have been picked up in some way, maybe there could have been a different outcome, and we're hoping for others that will be the case. This may not be enough, but it's a good start, and I'm hoping that there's more that we can do in later sessions. With that, I'll introduce Sue Aberholden, who's been a tireless advocate for mental health in this community, the committee is familiar with, and she is the head of NAMI and has been an inspiration to me and others. So I'm going to turn you over to Sue. Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. Aberholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI. 2 years ago, NAMI Minnesota began offering a free program to high school students called Ending the Silence. and it was developed by our national office. And it's a one-hour class that's taught by our staff and a young adult living with a mental illness who's doing well. And in the presentation, the students learn about signs and symptoms of mental illnesses, recovery, coping strategies, how to help friends, how to reduce stigma, and other important topics. And we reached over 3,400 students just last year. And what we found is that nearly every time that we present the program, a student comes forward who is worried about a friend or even themselves. And we've heard afterwards that many students actually go to teachers. And because of those responses, we did advocate for the bill in 2016 to require teachers to have continuing education on suicide prevention. We wanted to make sure that they knew what to do if a student approached them. The bill passed, and it did include wording that the education be evidence-based, so there's actually research on its effectiveness. Since it's only a one-hour class, the options are actually limited. One of the classes is called QPR, Question, Persuade, and Refer, and it provides, you know, basic information about suicide prevention. But it's hard for schools to actually organize all the teachers to attend that 1 hour. And we've provided the QPR free to schools. We did 42 just in the last 2.5 months, and it is pretty intensive for our staff to go out throughout the state. But thanks to the increase in funding to the suicide prevention program in 2015, the Minnesota Department of Health actually funded this program called Cognito, and you have a handout, both testimonials from people who've taken it and research about it. There are three versions, elementary, middle school, and high school. It's been used to train over thousands of educators and has been adopted for statewide use in over a dozen states, including Texas, California, and Ohio, and cities such as New York City and Fairfax, Virginia. The Cognito at Risk for Educators is a one-hour online interactive gatekeeper training that prepares high school teachers and other school personnel to identify, approach, and refer students who are exhibiting signs of psychological distress, such as depression, anxiety, substance use disorder, and suicidal ideation. The scenario-driven programs were developed with mental health experts and educators to address common, relevant, and realistic challenges for students at each grade level. In full disclosure, the Department of Health grant was actually funded through NAMI for us to get it out to the schools, and it's proven to be very successful. There are currently 30 school districts, and over 1,000 teachers have received the training. And what we found is that it really is effective because it has those scenarios. What we've also learned in talking to school districts is that some of them have actually gone online to find programs or just had a speaker come in and share their story about suicide. That is not an effective way to teach teachers on how to respond to suicidal ideation. We want it to be evidence-based practices. So you can take this online training. You can fund it for every school in Minnesota. Every teacher can take it. Because it's online, they don't have to come together at one point. They can take it when it's convenient for them. The scenarios help them with real-life situations, which is much better than even the QPR training that we provide. And because we would fund it statewide, they, of course, have brought their costs way down in order to do that. We think this is a really easy and effective way to make sure that the teachers in the state of Minnesota know how to identify and help students. And we'd appreciate your support.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Averholden. Any questions for Representative Anselmo or for the witness, Ms. Averholden? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how much money do they, what's their profit margin on this?
Ms. Averholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I actually don't know. I just know that it's a lot cheaper doing it if you do the whole state. But I can find that out.
Representative Thiessen.
Representative Anselmo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can tell you the total amount of money being spent is $273,000, and that works out to about $44 per student. So I'm guessing it's not a big profit margin.
For school.
Yeah.
Representative Thiessen.
Well, I'm talking obviously about the profit margin for Cognito, not for the schools. You know, and they're owned by the Blackstone Group, you know, a huge private hedge fund. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with that?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Averholden or Representative Anselmo?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, what we looked at is whether it's on the SAMHSA's registry of best practices, because there are, again, so many types of suicide trainings that have not been tested, and this one has.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the research I looked at online showed that they did some of their own testing, but there's been no independent, at least as of June 2017, there's been no independent testing of whether it's effective or not. Do you have something different than that?
Ms. Abraholden.
We know it's listed on SAMHSA's registry, which is what we go to look for, especially around suicide, to look for suicide training that's effective.
Madam Chair, are there others listed on SAMHSA's registry?
Ms. Abraholden.
Representative Thiessen, yes, there are, including QPR, but there's not many that are 1 hour. Many of them are greater. Like Safe Talk is a 3 hour, Assist is a 2 day. There's not many suicide prevention trainings that are 1 hour, which is what we require in statute.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, we require in statute where?
Ms. Para.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, Section 122A187, which lists the teacher licensure renewal requirements. Subdivision 6 requires teachers with Tier 3 or 4 licenses to have at least 1 hour of suicide prevention best practices training.
Madam Chair, and that's every 5 years?
Ms. Parra.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, for Tier 3, well, under current law where these tiers have not gone into effect, yes, it's 5-year licenses. Once Tier 3 and 4 go into effect, the Tier 3 teachers are on 3-year terms and 4 are on 5-year terms.
Right. Representative Thiessen, and this was you weren't on the committee at that time, but Representative Seltzer, when she was here, this was legislation that she authored teachers to renew their license receive this training.
Madam Chair, but not choosing a particular company. I just don't know that I'm sure we have, but that we've actually named a for-profit company to provide the training in legislation.
I don't know, and I don't know if Nonpartisan has any reference to that. We'll have to ask for a look into that, and we'll get back to you. Other questions? Comments? If not, Representative Anselmo, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I appreciate the questions and the detail and what we need to do to make sure that we're getting the best value for the state. I can tell you that training like this is important, and we probably need to do a lot more. The after effects to a suicide in a family, a community, a school, and others is devastating. Thank you for your time. We would appreciate inclusion in the budget, if so.
All right, thank you. And with that, Representative Anselmo renews his motion that the House File 3167 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time. Thank you very much, Representative Anselmo. All right, and now all right, and so there is another bill. This is one that I am authoring, so I'm just going to go ahead and move it from here. And I would move that House File 3320 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at another time. The premise of this bill would allow long-term facilities maintenance revenues to be used for school safety upgrades and improvements. And I'm going to allow nonpartisan staff to kind of go through. There is an information sheet in your packet that talks about this program. And just for members to be refreshed, this is a program that was actually initiated as part of the budget bill that was passed in 2015. So it was made available to all schools, and it's being phased in. It is a local levy plus an equalization or state money component to it. And so I thought it would be helpful just to have Mr. Strom or Ms. Adrians or our nonpartisan staff kind of go through what this program does so we have that baseline of knowledge for the bill. So, Mr. Strom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. There's two documents in the same packet with the bill and the bill summary. The first is a three-page sheet-oriented portrait style that says long-term facilities maintenance revenue at the top. And the second is a district-by-district printout showing the revenue under that program divided into the aid and levy components for last year, which was fiscal year 17, this year fiscal year 18, and the estimated levels for next year, fiscal year 19. As the chair said, the long-term facilities maintenance revenue was created by the 2015 legislature, first effective for fiscal year 2017. It took four separate programs and combined those programs into essentially one program with a new formula-driven part that applied to nearly all the school districts in the state. The two main programs that were combined into it, health and safety revenue, has existed since 1990, and that program was not a per-pupil program, but rather allowed school districts to correct facility safety and health-related deficiencies with their buildings, but it was a very project-specific program. It was on a rolling three-year basis, and there was a lot of consternation about how the funding for that changed for districts each year. The second part of the program combined in was the Alternative Facilities Revenue Program, and that program applied to the 25 largest school districts in the state and allowed those districts to do whatever amount of deferred maintenance revenue without voter approval that they needed to do through board action. So when these programs were rolled together then, the long-term facilities maintenance revenue created a per-pupil minimum. You can see those amounts in the second paragraph, $193 per pupil for fiscal year 2017, $292 per pupil for fiscal year 18, and $380 per pupil for fiscal year 2019. If you turn to the third page of that explanatory sheet, you can see the chart that shows the alternative facility districts that in fiscal year 16, the year prior to this program's creation, that they were on average spending about $572 on these categories of revenue, while the other districts in the state were spending about $313. And then you can see over time in fiscal year 17 that the other districts gained a bit. Fiscal year 18 came up pretty substantially, and then in fiscal year 19, another substantial increase for all the rest of the districts of, in the state. Long-term facilities maintenance revenue is currently for deferred maintenance-style activities, essentially like-for-like replacement of building deficiencies. It doesn't allow new construction, and it doesn't allow substantial remodeling. The changes proposed in Representative Loon's bill would allow those two activities to occur as long as they're related to school safety needs. That's primarily the biggest change that's in House File 3320. A couple other words about the program. It's about three-quarters levy and one-quarter aid, perhaps a little more than that. On the district-by-district printout, the amounts are shown on a per-pupil basis there. So if you look in fiscal year 18, there's 944,783 pupils. The average revenue is $444 per pupil unit. The levy share, $356, and the aid share, $88. And then you can see the proposed estimated levels under the current formulas for fiscal year 19 as well. So, Madam Chair, the fiscal 19 is the last year of the phase-in, and so for years fiscal 20 and forward, it's expected that the revenue will look much similar to fiscal year 19 than the growth that occurred over the last couple of years.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Any questions for Mr. Strom or for myself? And I believe some of the testifiers might want to address this as well, but I just wanted to get the bill out there so people understood what it was. I'm just going to lay it over for today. We're obviously not taking any action, but as I prefaced the beginning of the hearing with my remarks, I think this is one idea for how we could help give our schools flexibility to do safety improvements to their school as they see that they may need to or would like to do, and a stream of funding that they currently have that they could now use for this purpose if this was to be approved. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. I have met with my school superintendent on the school safety issue, and this is one of the items that they brought up as a real solution to helping the facilities get up to speed for school safety. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Teason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So could you, Mr. Strom, just go over what the money is used for currently? So kind of what would be, I don't know if we're putting more money into this or not, but what would be lost or if we put it into school safety as opposed to whatever else is used for?
Madam Mr. Chair, Strong. Representative Peason, on the second page of the three-page handout, there's a list of the qualifying revenue purposes toward the bottom of that page, and it may be used for deferred maintenance projects. Those are often roofing projects, window projects, tuck pointing, all those kinds of things tend to fall under the term deferred maintenance. Facility accessibility, this is a much smaller category. Many of the school districts have been making facility accessibility changes over time, and so there's less of those. And then certain health and safety repairs for things like removing asbestos and those kinds of things are in that category as well. But it's primarily now the deferred maintenance projects and with the standard that's essentially like for like, that is that when you replace something, you should put down relatively the same materials that were in use before. So those are the activities that are currently that districts are currently spending the long-term facilities maintenance revenue on.
And Madam Chair?
Representative
Thiessen. Do we know from this, maybe this is for Mr. Strong too, but do we know from the school districts whether the current, have they been concerned about the level of current funding for just these programs? I mean, is there more need already than there is of than the dollars?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, let me back up one more step as well. Oftentimes, school districts will hold a bond issue for renovation purposes. And for nearly all districts, the bond issue requires voter approval. But sometimes districts with a great number of deferred maintenance projects will do those through a bond issue. So I'd say the short answer is districts can always find, generally speaking, more deferred maintenance items than is covered by this formula. And sometimes we'll see, particularly with some of the suburban school districts, that they'll go for a bond issue simply for deferred maintenance projects in their buildings.
Okay. Other questions? And so I do have some people who want to testify specifically on the proposal. Brad Lundell, Patricia Magnuson, Dave Mordock, if you wanted to come down. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell here today on behalf of Schools for Equity and Education. I think Representative Thiessen kind of hit at some of the concerns that we have with House File 3320. Turn the clock back to after the Newtown shooting back in 2012, and I think in 2013 there was also kind of a push for, and this was before the long-term facilities maintenance revenue was put in place, but one of the problems with that, I think they talked about putting taking the health and safety levy and including improvements for security in that levy. But again, what happened is that when we started talking about the resource question and what kind of resources would be displaced because of that because of changes, that kind of ran into a brick wall and really didn't go anywhere. I think the real question here for us is, and I think that you have different districts that are at different levels in the long-term facilities maintenance. Some are going to have a lot of revenue available, or not a lot of revenue, but more than other districts. And so I think that that kind of puts a blanket over the ability of some districts to be able to make the kinds of improvements that they may need to do. I think putting the charters in is warranted. I think that, you know, charters have many of the same challenges, and I think doing that, we certainly think that's appropriate. But the resource question, I think, for the aggregate resource question for all school districts in the state, I think really needs to be addressed here. And how you do that, if you would take this and put this into a different, separate fund that would be facilities related, but would run kind of with the same equalizing factors, but you would have the safety and then differentiate that from the long-term facilities maintenance. That may be something you want to look at. But clearly, this is something that is really an item that needs to be addressed, and we're certainly supportive of your efforts to bring this forward for discussion and whatever we can do to, you know, put in our 2.5 cents as we move forward. I'm certainly glad to do.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Ms. Magnuson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Patricia Magnuson. I'm the Executive Director of Finance and Operations for Osceola Area Schools, and I'm here with Dave Mordock. He's our Coordinator of Risk Management, and it's a fairly new role in Osceola, and it's important because Dave is a former police officer and security manager before coming to Osceola Area Schools. He's a certified protection professional with ASIS International, and he's a member of the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals. So we're very fortunate to have him on our staff. So he's most knowledgeable about the safety and security aspects of our schools. Osceola Area Schools is the fifth largest school district in the state of Minnesota. We serve nearly 21,000 students, and we represent eight communities. It's over eight communities in the state of Minnesota. Our buildings, we have 32 buildings that range from the early 1950s to about 2002. And this has been important in Osceola Area Schools for a long time. It's actually been on our legislative platform for several years, converting long-term facility maintenance for use for safety and security, because one of the key characteristics of an effective school is a healthy work and learning environment. I want to have Dave talk to you a little bit about the urgency that we are especially feeling now since the Parkland shooting and how our community has interacted with us, and also describe how we've already thought through the facility improvements that we need to make in our schools.
Thank you. Welcome. And if you would please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Dave Mordock. I'm the Coordinator of Risk Management for Osceola Area Schools. So, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for letting me speak with you today. In the wake of the Parkland, Florida tragedy, I have taken numerous phone calls from concerned parents of what we are doing to keep their kids safe every day. The overwhelming theme from these conversations is we need to do more to keep kids safe, and we need to do it now. Parents and guardians entrust us with the safety of over 20,000 students a day in Osceola Area Schools, and it's important that we do everything possible to ensure that they have a safe place to learn and for employees to work. In Osceola Area Schools, we are proactive and have a plan that includes over $16 million worth of security improvements. The challenge we face is that with our current pace of our security investments within existing funding mechanisms, will take us 27 years to have that under realization, not including our regular updates, which will be needed over that time frame. We know that what we need to do to improve the safety and security in our schools. We also know that in order to pay for these essential works, we need to have a more flexible funding mechanism. Because those safety and security investments are not. Yep. Schools are normally considered soft targets, and we don't have the sophisticated security systems that you would see what you would see in the private sector. Target hardening includes access control systems, so card access systems, security alarms, security cameras, laminated safety glass, vestibules that confine people to be buzzed into the school. And our plan to do some target hardening in Osceola Area Schools would cost $16 million. These dollars would allow us to add secure entryways at three of our high schools, but also allow us to add physical security technology to assist staff in monitoring and controlling visitor access to main offices and to detect when doors are propped or left open. We also want to look at the way we improve our communication within our building, so moving from an analog radio system to a digital radio system, and also interfacing with new fire alarm systems that would allow us to use voice evacuation and messaging in times of an emergency.
So I want to talk a little bit about why we need a new funding source for safety and security. Currently, we have operating capital funding, which is available to us, and that is so safety and security could be funded out of operating capital, but it competes with the needs for curriculum additions, for technology, for general maintenance and repair of our buildings. So it's competing for that same limited funding source. So, for example, in our planning for fiscal year 19, for next year, we have about $5 million of operating capital funds available to us in Osceola Area Schools. 51% of that helps us replace curriculum, textbooks and other curricular items for our classrooms. Another 24% of that replaces equipment at the sites, desks and chairs and other equipment at our school sites. Another 13% covers district-wide technology needs like our firewall system, our system backups, and that leaves about 12% of our funding for safety and security. So for next year, of our $16 million plan, we are able to dedicate about $600,000 to safety and security. Half of that is just to begin upgrading our security cameras. So it just competes for dollars with other things. So what happens, I heard you refer to earlier, sometimes school districts can go to a bond issue for things like deferred maintenance and even for safety and security. In Osceola Area Schools, we estimate that it will cost us $150,000 to run a special election. And when we're doing that, it strains the time of community volunteers, of staff members, and it detracts us from other things that we should be doing for the students in our schools. And we cannot even advocate for a yes vote at our local community level. There's local controlled funding mechanisms in place, but like LTFM, their uses are limited by current law, and safety and security doesn't have a place in dedicated funding. So there are funds, and they are at the discretion of the elected school boards, operating capital being the main one in place, and that is dedicated toward curriculum. The Safe Schools Levy, $36 per pupil unit, for Osceola Area Schools generates $800,000. The majority of that funds our investment in our school resource officers at our school sites. One of the problems with the Safe Schools Levy, because it runs through the general fund, we do not have bonding authority. And investments like $16 million, you'd want to fund over time, over the lifetime of the investment. And that's how we invest school improvements. And there's no bonding authority under the Safe Schools Levy. Lease levy is another option. It cannot be used for non-instructional use. So it's often used to put additions onto schools. So it's limited as well. Long-term facility maintenance makes a lot of sense. There's bonding authority in place. It's at the discretion of the local school board, who understands not only the needs for deferred maintenance, but they're listening to parents and listening to us as staff, where the gaps are. And our board has long supported the idea through our own local platform to expand the use. Of course, the board might have to make some choices, and we can help prioritize the choices between deferred maintenance and long-term facility maintenance. We are a fortunate district who is one of the 25 that used to qualify for alternative facilities funding. I would advocate that the per pupil amount of revenue be expanded so other districts can invest in the way we might be able to if this were expanded. Treat it more like health and safety so that districts can go through a process of approval through the Department of Education. Either way, this is a critical change for us. And as I said, we have long known that this was a gap in our funding. The recent events have made this more apparent, and I'm very thankful to you for introducing this bill and hope that that you will consider it. And we'd be happy to take any questions at this time if you have any.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Magnuson and Mr. Mordock. Any questions for these witnesses? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So first a question maybe to Mr. Strom. So I'm just looking at your spreadsheet here, and it looks like Osseo Schools is going to get total revenue of $498,000 out of the levy in 2018, $446 from property taxes and $52 from state aid. Am I reading that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, these are shown as amounts per pupil, so we could fit them on the page. So if you multiply the $498 of revenue by the 22,000 pupils.
So what's the number then?
That is $11.2 million, if that full amount, the 498 times the 22,000.
Okay, thank you. And
Representative Thiessen.
So about a tenth of that is from aid, and one-tenth is from property taxes that they can levy?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes, it's an equalized aid and levy, and the equalizing factor is set just a little above the state average tax base for pupil.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Okay, thank you. And do you use your full amount of, have you levied the full amount?
Madam Chair, Ms. Magnuson. Thiessen, yes. We have levied our full amount, and in addition, we have long-term facility maintenance revenue through the debt service fund. That's our pay-as-you-go levy, and we also match it with a debt service that really helps us to expand. We have about $200 million of deferred maintenance projects over the next 10 years. So that's how we have been funding those, through a combination of pay-as-you-go levy and then a bond issue through the debt service fund.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, okay, so you have $200 million in deferred maintenance, you said?
Over the next 10 years.
So about $20 million a year?
Right, yeah.
Okay. And you get $11.2 million per year from the long-term facilities aid. So how much so you're doing another $9 million from other bonding?
Ms. Magnuson.
Yes. Representative Loon, we do. So we do a combination of debt service through a bond issue and local property tax, so a local pay-as-you-go levy. And, yes, actually we have front-end loaded these projects. So we're doing about $30 million of projects last summer and in the next three summers, and we hope that once we catch up, $20 million a year is about the investment we will need to make to keep up with the deferred maintenance in our 31 buildings.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just trying to so how are you going to fit the $16 million in then?
Ms. Magnuson.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we would have to reprioritize, or we would have a conversation with our school board and our community about whether we wanted to expand the amount of funding we would place toward safety and security on top of our deferred maintenance. Again, we are a fortunate district that is not limited by the $380 per pupil. We'd have to have a conversation among staff and our board about reprioritizing. And we can't have the conversation right now because we are not allowed to use long-term facility maintenance funding for safety and security. This will allow us to have that conversation and prioritize those items together.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But you could have, they could have passed the bond referendum when they did a previous referendum. I mean, you had said that this has been a conversation that's been ongoing for several years. Mm-hmm. So have you had that conversation with the board before about reprioritizing when you went out for a bond issue previously?
Ms. Magnuson.
Chair, Representative Thiessen, I have been in the district for about 4 years. We have not been out for a bond election in that time. Again, it costs $150,000 to run a special election, so it's not a small undertaking. And as I said, we cannot advocate for yes votes on that. I personally think about it as an item that we understand and know is necessary, similar to deferred maintenance, and our locally elected school board members are in the best position to make decisions about that. And we do hold truth and taxation hearings annually where we can discuss those items with our communities.
And Madam Chair, just other one clarifying question. Are we putting any more money into aid for this?
Representative Thiessen, not at this time, because those are questions I think to be answered down the road once we have more information about supplemental spending and that. So, it's the intention of the chair just to lay this bill over for now until we have more answers to some of those questions. Other questions for the testifiers? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for being here. We really appreciate it, and thanks for the information, Mr. Mordock. I think that's very helpful for all of us. All right. Other questions on the bill? If not, I will lay it over, and then we're going to hear from a number of testifiers on school safety, starting with the Department of Public Safety on a grant program that goes to train school resource officers and do other things. All right, if not, I will renew my motion that House File 3320 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time. And with that, I'd like to call down the Minnesota School Safety Center from the Department of Public Safety. We have Deputy Director Kevin Reed and School Safety Director Randy Johnson. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
And in whichever order you'd like to testify, gentlemen, if you please just introduce yourself for the record. And you are going to tell us about a grant that is funded through the Department of Public Safety but is used to help our schools with school safety. So welcome today.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. For the record, my name is Joe Kelly. I'm the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. My deputy's right behind me, ready to make any and all corrections to my testimonies. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to brief the committee on the Minnesota School Safety Center. The terrible school shooting in Parkland, Florida, has once again placed the safety of our children while they're at school top of mind. The Minnesota School Safety Center was reestablished by the legislature in 2013. Going back to 2007, it was originally a federal grant-funded program and was known then as the Safe Learners Program. The mission of the School Safety Center, simply stated, which Mr. Johnson will elaborate in more detail on, is to help local Minnesota schools provide a safe and secure environment for students, families, teachers, staff, and visitors. We serve Minnesota's K-12 public, private, charter, and tribal schools, and we strive to help them be better prepared to effectively respond to incidents at their schools and to quickly recover from its effects. While the center works very closely with the Minnesota Department of Education, it is a program of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And, Madam Chair, before I turn it over to Mr. Johnson, I would like to clarify something. Our program is funded by the General Fund for staff that provides services to the schools that Mr. Johnson is going to talk about. We do not have a grant program to local schools for them to contract, if you will, for those services. Madam Chair and members, I yield to my colleague, Mr. Randy Johnson.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Randy Johnson. I'm the Director of Training and School Safety Center for Homeland Security Emergency Management, Department of Public Safety. It's a mouthful. I wish to thank you for the opportunity to give you just a thumbnail look at what the Minnesota School Safety Center is and what we do for all of our schools throughout the state of Minnesota. Again, as Director Kelly said, it is for K-12 schools, public, private, charter, and tribal. And our mission is to really provide training and resources for schools, all the schools, to address that full spectrum of emergency responses, all hazards planning. And right now, with the tragedy that occurred down in Florida, we're very much focused on violent acts or violent intruders within the schools. But the School Safety Center provides training and resources to schools on the full spectrum of emergency operations planning, whether it is a human-caused event or whether it's a natural disaster. So we do identify all threats and hazards that could impact the school. And what we do is we link resources between the school and those public safety partners and community partners to provide the strongest, safe, and healthy learning environment schools can have. Minnesota School Safety Center is staffed with 3 full-time people. We're not a very large group, but we're a mighty group as far as the activities that we perform. I'm the director. We have one person who is a staff member, is the school resource officer coordinator, and the second person is the safe school assessment coordinator. We used to have a position, emergency planning coordinator, which is now vacant. Our funding mechanism, budget-wise, didn't allow us to maintain that third position. But over recent years, we've been cross-training all of our members so we can adequately cover all the responsibilities in all of these areas that we provide services to for our public safety partners in school. And what we found ourselves being is very much less subject matter experts, but we're subject matter learners, where we go throughout the state of Minnesota and share best practices that are employed throughout Minnesota and throughout the country for school safety. We have many key partners that we do operate with, and again, the School Safety Center is not a responding organization. We don't turn lights and siren and head across country. We are a resource provider and a connector between schools and their key partners. Regional educational cooperatives have been a very strong partner of ours for pushing out training and education pieces to school boards, administrators, and even line staff. We also connect directly with public safety agencies, which are the local, county, state, and tribal agencies, work with professional associations, such as the Minnesota School Board Association and principal associations. We've even linked up with higher education, principal and superintendent licensing programs to make sure that as persons are going for licensure as superintendents or principals, they're aligned already with the different things that we need to be thinking about in all hazards training. State agencies, again, they're listed. I won't go through them, but strong partners with Department of Health, Department of Ed, especially public safety with Office of Communications, State Fire Marshal, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Minnesota State Patrol for transportation student issues, and also the Office of Justice Programs along with our federal partners. I have a list here of some of the courses and training topics that we do share with our schools and with our public safety partners. And you can see it covers a wide range of activities. And we're continually adding, updating, and changing course curriculum to incorporate best practices and the best learning that we have from events that are occurring throughout the country. And we do many times customize these trainings to the audience that we are making the delivery to, whether it is school administrators, line staff, public safety, or other community partners. It's a little bit difficult to see on this slide, and I apologize for that, but I wanted to give you a representation of how our delivery is throughout the entire state of Minnesota. We are not a metro-centric group of trainers. We spend an awful lot of time in greater Minnesota. We have to be present and walk with the schools and their public safety partners. We actually have to have our feet within the buildings and spend a lot of time listening to what their needs are and what their own self-identified gaps in safety and security needs are. Annually, we train about 1,300 individuals, about 6,500 contact hours annually, and we touch about 200 schools per year. When you look at the rendering here on that state map, the darkened areas are school districts that we have made a contact with either through direct training or making a site visit. That's not counting all of the phone calls that we receive or requests for additional resources that we provide many other schools throughout the state. So I would be fairly safe to say that we do contact pretty much all the schools and school districts throughout the state on an annual basis. And what we've learned over the 4 years that I've been involved with the School Safety Center is that each and every school is unique. Each school district is unique, especially when we're looking across the range of the larger school districts versus charter schools versus some of the private schools and even the tribal schools. So we really have to spend time and understand what are their concerns. What does the brick-and-mortar facility look like? Because it's going to be very different even within a single district, as far as how we're going to best serve and have that safe and healthy learning environment. And also, we've learned very, very deeply that the different resources that are available vary significantly depending upon where you are in the state. That's especially as far as partner resources and public safety. One of the key things that we've been very, very positive about is that we are a non-regulatory group, which makes quite a difference when we're working with schools where we're not going to be looking for ways to issue citations or fix-it tickets. We're there to listen to them and to actually hear what is going on within their schools, and building that strong relationship and that statewide presence is an actual requirement. On-site delivery is crucial to our success. I've highlighted just a few of the trainings that we were asked to speak to this committee on, school resource officer training. We perform about 75 school resource officers trained per year, and that is both in our basic schools and our advanced strategies courses. And we do help them coordinate their active shooter, violent intruder training, of course, responding to bomb threats, and threat assessment. De-escalation strategies are on high on the list of needs for the schools as they requested to us. But we also helped the school resource officers make the shift from street to school, because it's a significant shift in the way that they are doing their daily work. We liaison to law enforcement officers and school resource officers throughout the state and engage in emergency response exercises. 2014, MDA did a survey of school resource officers, and at that time there was estimated 315 or so school resource officers throughout the state, either in a full-time or a part-time status. And that those officers came from 158 of approximately 448 recognized law enforcement agencies in the state. So roughly about 37-38% of law enforcement agencies actually have school resource officers deployed into their local schools. School threat assessments has been a very, very hot topic among the schools and their public safety partners over the past couple of years, actually. And we help provide threat assessment training to team members, both school personnel, community members that are going to be coming in support of the school's behavioral health specialists, and also the public safety partners. We review after-action reports for events and incidents that occur in Minnesota and throughout the state to provide additional best practices to the schools as they develop their own plans. We also look at long- and short-term support for the victims and the part that a lot of us don't think about too much, supporting the reintegration strategies for returning students once they've been involved in an incident like this. Safe school facility assessments is another, you know, very high item as far as requests from our schools and public safety partners. We do about 80 of these per year throughout the state. And it's not necessarily a technical facility assessment where we're making particular and direct recommendations for certain types of technologies within the school, but it's more of an overall look where we're identifying some of the areas that schools have concerns. We usually ask the question of them, what keeps you up at night? And they pretty much identify by themselves what are the areas that they are concerned about. We use SEPTED principles, crime prevention through environmental design, and we share solutions that other schools have come up with that could be applied in other school districts throughout the state. Emergency operations planning, again, this is all hazards planning. We work with schools as they develop exercises and drills, both tabletop exercises to full-scale exercises, and we assist them with the development of those exercises. The final thing I would talk to today that I was asked is the school crisis response teams at 119A.035. This is actually under the oversight of the Department of Education. We did provide the School Safety Technical Assistance Center some resources and identified some model programs that were already up and running throughout the country, and then especially one that is operating in southwestern Minnesota, the Southwest West Central Crisis Response Team. And it's really a good model that that we looked at and identified and has been very successful in that area. So we provide cooperative services and support the Department of Education as they are moving forward on these school crisis response teams. So, Madam Chair and members, I really thank you again for the opportunity to present kind of a snapshot of the work of the Minnesota School Safety Center within the Department of Public Safety, and I'm open to any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Kelly. Representative Scott, I saw your hand go up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here today. I see that you have a $405,000 ongoing appropriation. Is that annual or is that for biennium?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, that's the annual.
Well, thank you. That's not going to go very far for 2 years. Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to focus on the school resource officer training. As you know, it's a very controversial topic. And I've got some series of questions that we probably won't get to all of them to the mercy of the committee. You indicate that 158, how do I think about this? What percentage of school resource officers in the state are trained as school resource officers?
Madam Chair
and members, I don't have that off the top of my head, how many were trained specifically through the Minnesota School Safety Center. There are other organizations that train school resource officers, such as NASRO, National Association of School Resource Officers. They have a program that is similar to ours, but I can't give you a number off the top of my head how many precisely within the state are trained by either of our organizations.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. Are there any standards for training in statute, any standards for selection of school resource officers, any assurance the community has that the officer assigned to the school is trained in the appropriate choice, because the cop who may be great, you know, pulling me over for speeding may not be the one to best deal with my teenager. So what assurances do we have that the right people are being chosen and trained, and what standards do we have in statute around that in Minnesota?
Chair and members, I do not believe that there's anything statutorily in place that has any requirements on particular things that the school resource officer must have before going to the school. What I do know is, in talking with chief law enforcement officers throughout the state, they recognize the criticality of the selection of the person to be going into the schools, because this is a representative of everything that they have as far as public trust. And they are very, very particular in who they do select to be placed into the schools.
Representative Dabney.
One last question, Madam Chair. Thank you. What training do you provide the administrators in the schools that have SROs placed there? And I think of coffee I had with a school staff person recently in an elementary school that had an SRO. And she drew out two instances, one where a younger elementary student, in her words, quote-unquote, stole a piece of candy off of a teacher's desk. The school brought in the school resource officer and dealt with it as a criminal issue with the police officer, which was terrifying for the child, traumatic. And certainly if there's a goal of building positive relationships between students and law enforcement, didn't make the grade on that one. On the other hand, when there was a non-custodial parent with an order against them demanding to get access to their child, she was very pleased to have a police officer in the building to stand that person down. I see a chunk of it as the officer having to deal with the officer and that discipline issue. I also see part of it as the administrator inappropriately using law enforcement. So what training do you provide administrators to assure that they're using the officer within the scope of their professional training and not outside that scope?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and members, one of the things that we do is we invite administrators to attend portions of the training for the actual school resource officers, and that's especially important if it's a new administrator or a new resource officer program that is being established. One of the things that we are very, very clear with when we're doing the training of school resource officers is there's a difference between what their role is as far as investigating criminal activity and school discipline. So it is very, very clear that school resource officers in our training are not school disciplinarians and not to be used in that mode or in that operation within their schools. A lot of that has to be communication between administrators and also at the higher level when contracts are being made between public safety agencies and the schools, so they can clearly delineate what are the responsibilities of the school resource officer in the school setting and what is not. So those are the conversations that need to really, really happen, and we do explore that with our training when we go out throughout the state talking to school administrators.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your testimony today, Mr. Johnson, and for the work that you do as well. I'm learning a lot here. I have a couple of questions, but one just to piggyback on Representative Dabney very quickly. You mentioned on the SRO training, and of course, there are no state statutes that provide standards. I do know that. So I think you're correct about that. You did mention a reference to, I imagine, professional national standards might be the wrong word, but some professional rubric that some officers may have access to. Can you speak a little bit to your knowledge about whether any of that involves training around racial implicit bias?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, we do bring those parts and pieces into the training courses, both at the basic level and at the advanced strategies level. We're always looking for current things that are happening within the school environment that will make school resource officers sensitive to the community that they serve, and especially with young people in the school.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, that's really important to do, and it sounds like you share in that, that sentiment as well. I want to talk a little bit about prevention, my language, prevention versus intervention or response. So I'm looking at the school response, crisis response team, one with the reference to 119A.035 in your slide, where there's mention of public behavioral health partners. I take it that really has to do with access to those professionals within a response framework. Mm-hmm. And what I'm really interested in is just some quick thoughts from you in terms of a proactive prevention-focused framework. So earlier when you talked about safe school facility assessments, you shared that one of the sort of basic interactions with schools is to just ask schools, you know, what's keeping you up at night, I think is what you said. I wonder if you could share with us, when you ask that question, how often, if at all, does the answer to that fall in the prevention side as opposed to the response side to that? And let me be really specific. Are you hearing from schools that one of the things that keeps us up at night are perhaps not having the best relationships with our students, perhaps not deploying the best behavioral health professionals to be able to interact with our students in a different way?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, that is part of our conversation, and it does come up frequently. And we talk about many times that sometimes technologies aren't going to be that one panacea or going to be that, you know, for, I hate to say this, that magic bullet. We don't want to talk about things like that. But we also recognize that relationships are critical. Relationships are critical whether it's a school resource officer and students. Relationships are critical between the school resource officers and staff members. Relationships are critical in having that one adult voice, that one adult relationship one-on-one with kids within that school and building that culture within the school of safety and being able to really communicate and have that strong, strong bonding with other persons within the community. And that is one thing that we talk about quite a bit within the schools. It's not just technology pieces such as video and hardening vestibules and that type of thing, but it's the actual relationship building within the school environment is most important.
And then, Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, I'll put you on the spot a little bit here. I would concur with that, I'll call it well-rounded, conversation. What's your general sense? So this is to put you on the spot a little bit, question. What's your general sense about our collective ability to properly resource that reality, that ability to build those kinds of human interactions? You don't have to quantify it, but can we do better? Can we do way better? Do we need to do better in that arena?
Mr. Johnson.
Well, Madam Chair and members, this is my own opinion to a degree. Absolutely. We can always do better. This is very, very intentional work, and it takes huge effort. And I see that throughout the state when we are working with schools, whether they're the little teeny tiny private school up in the far northwestern corner of the state, St. Vincent, with 35 kids in the school, all the way down to the very, very large districts, such as the largest one in Okehannafin. That is a focus of the work that they are doing. And it does play into that 360-degree approach to dealing with school safety for all persons within the community and within the school community.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, I want to take you back to the school threat assessment slide. I'm interested to know, you mentioned school personnel and public safety partners, what other components would make a successful threat assessment team?
Representative Johnson. Or Mr. Johnson, excuse me. Demoted you.
Madam Chair and members, I think we have to be thinking outside of the box when we're talking about all the people that need to be able to help us have a full view of what is going on in this one individual's life when you identify something that could potentially be a threat. And a lot of times it's actually being able to talk to all the players that may have a piece in this person's life. It can be parents. It can be someone from a faith community that they are with. We talk to friends. We talk to school teachers. We talk to all the supplemental staff within the schools, because sometimes they're the ones that have the closest relationship and a read on what is going on in somebody's life. The custodial staff, the food service workers, the coaches. These are very, very important persons that we need to grab these little pieces to get that 360-degree view rather than just what I see through my lens. I need to see through somebody else's lens. And when we're teaching, we do this. I need to see through this lens, too. Someone's got to tell me because I'm blind to it. I did not see that myself. So we really have to, you know, gather in all the professionals and all the persons that may have had some sort of a touch in a person's life to be able to actually have some sort of a 360-degree look at what is going on.
Representative Jergens.
I'm glad to hear that, because it sounds like it's going to be different in every situation is going to be a little bit different. There is no one-size-fits-all. So let me give you an example, then, of a student who is expelled for disciplinary reasons. What is the best way to handle that situation? If the student is expelled, then the school is, you know, more hands-off. So is there a handoff, then, to other individuals, other people within this threat assessment team, then? How would that be handled in a perfect scenario?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, that's kind of on the MDE side, the education side, as far as how they handle internally with the policies and procedures that they have in place. Our role is going to be more in the gathering of information and helping them discern what they are going to be doing as the next step, both short-term and long-term, for those persons that may have been a target or a victim in that type of a threat. And also maintaining that same steady, strong focus on the person that made the threat, because we're going to need to be helping that student also. But that is kind of under the purview and the direction of the school officials.
Representative Jergens.
Because I guess what I was getting at is outside of the school. So that student is no longer in that school, but he or she may be the future threat. So is there, you know, is law enforcement brought in, or mental health professionals, or, you know, some of these other people, parents and faith organizations that you mentioned, would they then be, in a perfect world, they would be brought in to keep an eye on this person, so to speak?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, that is correct, you know, because there is some cascading downstream work that will be necessary, you know, as a person is still within the community. And that allows that group together to come up with the best solutions possible for that individual.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Slocum?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Moran?
Oh, I was going to.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I had said, oh, no, I don't need to. I'll tell you what they do when you have someone expelled is the principals in the area have trade kind of deal where they call up the principal who owes them and they say, will you take this kid? As far as services, very minimal, if any. And there's a trade. They trade up. So somebody takes the kid with minimal services, but they do know why the kid is transferred, but the kid is basically transferred to a different school. Now, sometimes there is an expulsion where the kid is expelled from that school district, okay? But then the principals call the adjoining school district. Sometimes the superintendents need to, and they do a trade-up. And that's reality. I've been there.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and excuse me if I ask a question about something that you've testified on already. So the Minnesota School Safety Center was established in 2013, so you've probably been up and going since at least 2014. Mm-hmm. And so I noticed that you've trained over 1,300 individuals and been in at least 200 schools, and you have three staff. You have three. And so I'm trying to get a better picture on how you do what you do to have been in so many schools to train so many individuals.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, those numbers are annually. We're really busy. The grass does not grow beneath our feet. But we're very energized in our work because it is so exceptionally rewarding to work with the schools and their public safety partners and see the great work that they're doing. We stay extremely busy. Some of the school districts we will go into, say, a facility assessment, and we may be with them to walk through one school, and then we do it almost on a train-the-trainer basis. So they become the force multiplier to look at other schools with the team that we have trained. So, yeah, we are very busy. Right now I'm looking into the future as far as the requests over the past several weeks, and we are already booking out into May our facility assessments and training.
Representative Moran.
Madam Chair. So that was my thought process. You use a train-a-trainer model to do the work that you do. So I have another question. So you stated that you was a subject matter learner. What do you mean by that?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, we're surprised sometime with the workarounds that schools have developed to address some of their specific needs. And being a subject matter learner means that we are learning from school districts and being able to share some of the best practices that they've developed and make application to similar needs in other schools throughout the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Okay. You talk a little bit about what you have learned. I've heard you state over how important relationships are. Recognizing that every school, every district may be different. You have three staff, and you're using a train-a-trainer model. And like you, I too believe that relationships are really, really important. And it's important to realize that school by school may be different and the needs may look differently or maybe similar. And so I was just wondering, and I like the concept that you say you're blind to what you don't see or what you don't know, right? And so as you are going into different schools across the state, and I think what I'm hearing you saying is schools kind of like come up with the solutions themselves. You hear what they may be saying, and then you help them see how to facilitate those solutions. Is that kind of correct?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, what I'm trying to impart on you is when we are involved in a school assessment or training, many times they self-identify what some of the main issues are that keep them up at night. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes when we're doing a facility assessment or a training, we are that fresh set of eyes that comes through. It's kind of like in your own home. You have that stack of magazines that sits on the end table, and you really don't even see it after a while because it's just there all the time. And we have that fresh set of eyes that comes in and say, huh, why don't you tell me about this or how this is working for you or why are you using this procedure, this protocol? Why do you have this particular technology in place? And we learn very quickly from them, and they realize quickly whether or not it's a true benefit or there's a best practice that they should be following that has changed since they've implemented their current process.
One last question, I think, Madam Chair. So in looking at relationships, and I was just thinking, you know, often up in the urban schools and maybe so in rural and suburban too, but you have a large population, and we want to keep our schools safe. You know, and often enough, we're not really proactive. We don't have we don't have that lens of how to be proactive, or how to serve diverse groups of young people. And so, as you have gone across the state and worked in over 200 schools, I guess one, how diverse in ethnicity are those solutions to work, not to always see a threat, but maybe to see the trauma or to see the ACEs or the African Child experiences, that different, you know, the homelessness or whatever is going on, you know, is there trainings or opportunities to bring that type of conversations into the process so that, you know, as we work to keep schools safe, we are keeping kids in the school, in the class? So is there types of trainings that you do around that process?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, a lot of the trainings that we do do address those types of issues, and especially in the areas of communication and really understanding where people are within their community. I think I was a little bit surprised in some of my early days of traveling throughout the state and seeing the diversity even in greater Minnesota communities, and making sure that we are addressing those issues and supporting the schools in those endeavors, especially when we're dealing with some of the issues that we are with emergency management and planning. It's important to keep your eye on some of the populations that sometimes we are blind to.
Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for this report. Just in the sake of full disclosure, I'm a public school educator. So this, you know, is a very, very important issue to me, as it is to all of us. I'm just curious, you're in over 200 schools in the state of Minnesota. That's not every school district. Is there a particular type of training, a baseline fundamental training that you're advocating for students and school personnel? I know that the training that they still, you know, use in my district is probably pretty obsolete. There's I'm sure, some evidence of best practices that would, you know, challenge what my district is doing. And on your slide here, I'm not really sure. It's very small print, and I can't decide if my district is represented or not. So I'm just wondering, you know, is there a training? I've heard of different programs. Is there one that you find to be extremely solid and you advocate for? Or does yours have an acronym, for instance, that you might be – hinted. No, I'm not sure if you're behind the ALICE program in particular, but that's one that I'm curious about.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, you're talking about responding to a violent intruder type of an event?
Really, the training, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Really, the training that we receive isn't just in the case of a shooting. It's for any kind of an incident where there's perceived threat to our students or our personnel within a school setting. And as an educator, we're trained how to respond to different situations in certain ways. And I'm just wondering if there's an overarching baseline standard that you know, advocate for, whether it's one of your own or if there's a program out there that you can say, you know, you can't predict the specifics of any given situation, but these are some fundamentals that we should all be prepared for.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, I think what we're talking about is the overarching theme or idea of response training. So that's effective drills, effective large muscle movements, evacuations, shelter in place, these types of pieces. We do cover that in our overall emergency operations planning courses. But then we drill down to the specific courses to touch upon specific tactical, if I can use that term, responses that we do recommend. ALICE training is, you know, one of the programs that's nationally portrayed. And some schools are going along with that training. other schools are saying. It's not so much to what our community is really wanting to do, and we help them develop that they would see would fit within their own community needs.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have another question, and that's regarding a ratio of school resource officers. Is there a ratio per student that the industry thinks that, or that you folks think is a good number, or is it per square footage of the school itself? Because I know down in Parkland there was a pretty big campus, and they had one person only. So if you could address that issue, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, I'm not aware of any ratio or standard, you know, for square footage or numbers of student population for school resource officers. It's kind of the attorney answer. It depends. You know, maybe a larger ratio as you get down to the elementary level students. It may be a higher ratio if you're dealing with the middle school and the high school. But I'm not aware of any standard.
No. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Other question, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, what data do you collect to help you understand the needs in our districts? You know, do the SROs send anything to the safety center in the form of kinds of incidents or behaviors that may bring on certain reactions within our schools? When it comes to the responsibility of the SRO, do you collect any data, or will you start doing that now so that we can have a better base of how things transact in our schools?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, we don't collect that kind of data as far as spreadsheets, that type of thing, but we do respond to what the concerns and needs are, either it comes through the public safety agency, the school resource officer, but mostly it comes through the schools. We're contacted by administrators, and they say we're seeing an uptick in this, or we believe that we need to have some additional training in this area, as we were conversing with staff members and that type of conversation, and that's normally how it's brought to us.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you and the Department of Education share any, you know, do they send you any alerts or anything about behaviors that may be occurring, because they get a lot of data on student behavior?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, we do have contact with the Department of Ed, especially through the Technical Center, who is kind of our complementary mm-hmm. group that works with the bullying and those types of incidents and events within the schools. So we do communicate regularly when someone approaches them with a need which they believe we have the expertise to assist them with.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the Minnesota Safety Center is really, to me, it's like a high-level tactical type of training, real physical harm type of threats, and maybe less around maybe behavior modifications or looking at how to regulate, you know, behavior that could be foreseen as a threat or a personal threat or a shooting or a bombing or anything like that. Have there ever been any, like, requests from any of the 200 schools or lessons learned around maybe looking at the mental health part of this or behavior modification pieces that schools thought that more training in that piece would be helpful when looking at the safety of schools?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, those types of specific needs are addressed through the Department of Education, through our complementary group, the School Safety Technical Center. So they are the ones that work mainly in those areas, and we would defer those types of specialized requests to them.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Not seeing any other questions for these two witnesses. I want to thank you both, Mr. Kelly and Mr. Johnson, for being here with us. Thank you very much for your presentation. I think we all learned a lot and appreciate it. So if we have any other questions, we'll be sure to forward them to you. And would it be all right if we do that and you could submit answers in writing to the committee? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So I'm going to call down our first, I'm just calling them school safety panels. And I will note, obviously, we're going to run right up into our time at 2:45. I suspected this may be the case, so we did reserve room 5, this room, at 5 o'clock to come back. I just want to make sure that we allow, I had some calls from teachers. I want to make sure that we allow people who wanted to testify today to testify, and so we're going to come back if we need to do that and hear from whoever wants to talk. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I want to hear from who wants to talk as well. I'm concerned there may be some folks who aren't able to come back at 5. Are you going to screen for, are you going to take volunteers, set up a lottery, draws? How are we going to do this?
Well, I guess we can ask about folks who may not be able to come back. It's, I mean, do that? All right. So, and I can tell you who, I have only on the list people who called and told us they wanted to testify. If there are others, I just don't have your name on the list because I was not informed. Obviously, you're welcome to testify. We just put names on the list. So I have Grace Kelleher, Scott Kroonquist, Fred Nolan, Gary Amoroso. And then the next panel, I had a representative from Educators for Excellence. I don't have a name. Kate Schmidt and Don Sinner, both representatives from Education Minnesota. And Tom Baker. And are there others who wanted to testify? And if, is there someone who cannot come back at 5 o'clock who we need to get in right now? All right, going once, going twice. All right, so.
We're right there.
Well, we'll miss you, Representative Murphy, if you can't come back. Everyone has been recorded with their attendance for this meeting, so if you can't come back after the recess, we understand. So, all right, so I think we're just going to move ahead then. It looks like everybody can make it. So, I was going to say it's not even a chair. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead and pull a chair over, Mr. Amoroso. All right. Thank you all for being here. And I know I had met with most of you probably and asked you in advance of just opening up the topic to provide your feedback and your suggestions to all of us on what we could do to help schools improve safety. So with that, please, whatever order you want to go in, just introduce yourselves and we welcome your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director, Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I want to thank the Chair and Committee for an opportunity to share a couple of thoughts on this very, very important topic. I just want to start off by sharing that I know that all of the administrators and educators in the state, their number one priority is providing a safe environment for our students and staff. We didn't need the tragedy in Parkland to make that clear, but since that tragedy in Parkland, this conversation has once again come to the forefront and is one that is on everybody's mind. But I know that our educators care deeply about their children and want nothing more than to provide that safe environment for them. With that in mind, I know there had been some conversations about what type of resources we could put together. And, Madam Chair, your House File 3320, looking at the long-term facilities maintenance revenue, is one that we had mentioned to you, and we're very pleased and thankful that that is part of the conversation. Part of the conversation we had was around the school safe levy and how those resources are used. And I'd like to just share, we did a little bit of a dipstick with some of our members in greater Minnesota as well as the metro, just to give you a sense of how those dollars are currently being used. And by this, no means means that every school district is doing this. But in terms of how those dollars are being used, quite a few districts do use them towards liaison officers. I know we've just had a conversation about liaison officers. I'd like to share that our perspective, and I think the perspective of the superintendents in the state, is that liaison officers are there as a resource, are there in a collaborative fashion, and are not there to do discipline. Resource officers are not disciplinarians. That is not their role. They are there to assist and work with school personnel. But I know a lot of our districts do use this safe school levy for those purposes. We're also looking at how do we upgrade our facilities in terms of security cameras for our facilities, replacing doors to create more secure doors, the camera systems, just different things that we think we need to do from a physical perspective on our buildings to try and create a more safe environment. That's one aspect. I think another spoke that you have to talk about then is how do we help identify our students that need assistance, and when our students are identified as needing assistance, how do we provide that assistance? And I know there's been a lot of conversation in the legislature and in our schools about mental health of students, and that's a conversation that I'm hoping that we can continue to have as we move forward this year in creating some type of a recess pool or resource pool for mental health different activities, and have it be one that is not just viewed as the school district being responsible for providing those mental health services, but is there a collaborative opportunity between community and school district to work to provide those resources? And that would include funding not only from a school district perspective, but also funding from a community perspective. How do we bring those sources together to provide protocols, to provide assistance, to provide support, to provide treatment for students? Because it cannot just be the responsibility of the school districts to deal with the mental health of our students. With that, Madam Chair, I could go on, but I know we have other colleagues and others in the audience, so I would stand for questions. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I'll try to move it along because I have a feeling we're going to hit on a lot of the same topics, and I'll try not to do that. But as Mr. Amoroso mentioned, there are really two key avenues to look at, facilities and people. And we think you've covered two excellent proposals today that would hit each of those. The chair's proposal to expand the allowable uses of long-term facilities maintenance revenue is right on the mark. It's actually something that has been an idea for a while. The 2014 Working Group on School Facilities Financing recommended that. And so thank you very much for bringing that forward. It allows flexibility for school districts and communities to address the needs that they have. Likewise, the expanding the Safe Schools Levy, increasing the Safe Schools Levy would be a huge help, and I know Representative Anselmo has introduced legislation on that, which we are very appreciative of. And that, again, is the nice thing about that, local control and flexibility. Districts can use it on SROs, but it's also you can use it on counselors, social workers, psychologists. You can use it on security enhancements as well, but it's not a substantial enough source of revenue for really hitting those needs, and so they would be much more appropriate through the expansion of the long-term facilities revenue. So I'll stop there. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent all locally elected school board members from around the state, and we appreciate this opportunity to share our concerns about school safety. And we believe as an association there's a shift that has really happened in the state just with this last shooting, where people and board members finally say enough is enough. We are coming here and we presented you with a lot of ideas because we sort of opened it up to our membership and said, where would you need help? And I wish I could tell you that the details of the programs, you know, these only came from large districts and these only came from small districts. It's not like that. It really varies district to district. So the idea about having flexibility and the idea about expanding allowable uses is extremely beneficial around the state. We wanted you to consider the Safe Schools Levy. As I said, my folks are feeling pressure, and we want our kids to be safe. And I've got a little kid coming to start kindergarten, and I'd like to make sure she's safe going forward. So we think the long-term facility maintenance has the best equalization to make that tax effort the same around the state. We'd like you to look at the lease levy, operating capital, a lot of these which you'd have to go up in range for what we'd need. We think mental health funding is critical, along with staff support and staff training. And we'd like you to take a look at school drills and see if things like always running outside of the building for a fire drill is the wisest course. So just a whole myriad of things, but we appreciate this to be the start. And as I said, we feel this is a critical need this year.
Thank you very much, Ms. Keller. And I appreciate all of you, before we turn to you, Mr. Nolan, with some very specific suggestions. And so just so you know, just a reminder, the bill that I I brought to the committee today, and we laid down, I consider that just sort of a baseline of what I hope will be calm, a school safety package. So, and all of those other ideas, I hope other members will bring their ideas to the table too, so we can be very comprehensive in our approach. Mr. Nolan.
Yes, I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, representing 224 rural school districts across the state. I echo what my colleagues would say. Really appreciate you, Madam Chair, bringing this bill forward and the committee's attention. This has dominated the conversation among our school leaders, both in meetings outstate and here at the Capitol. We do represent the districts that are capped at $380 per pupil for long-term facility maintenance. And Mr. Strom presented you this chart where you can see up to 2019, the funding for our district slowly increased, and then it's just kind of flattening out. So not only would we ask that you use the possibly use them for improvements for safety, but continue the increase, which was recommended by the 2014 Facility Working Group. Another option that they had was recommendation number four, which was to use the lease levy for school improvements. That would be another avenue, so you wouldn't compete long-term projects versus school safety, but give schools really two funding mechanisms. We would like you to look at that. We also recognize that the school safety levy, for having staff relate to kids, having been systematically do that and proactively do that, as well as having other staff to support that, is inadequate. So that's a local levy. You're giving a tool to local communities to provide the safety for their kids. And we really appreciate the school safety group here. I've had great comments from my colleagues about working with them, how they come out and do walk through. We really appreciate their work and want to coordinate our school responses with local law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. You know, when we're sitting and talking about school safety, we all understand that this is a very, very complex issue. And we can look at it in a lens of being proactive, and we can look at it in a lens of how do we respond when something happens. The question for all of you, one of you, whoever would like to respond. I don't think there's going to, my personal opinion, there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution to the situation that we're addressing. We have kicked around the conversation of a full-service community school for at least a couple of sessions now. And my question to you is, do you see that as being one avenue of maybe getting at some of the situation by addressing the needs of the schools, the students, and your community as a whole, and then having some wraparound services, especially in the areas of mental health?
Anybody want to volunteer for that one? Mr. Frenquist.
Madam Chair, Member Scott Frenquist. Short answer, yes. I mean, I think we've had member districts that have taken advantage of that and applied, and I think there is more interest. So continuing to expand on that grant pilot project type program, I think, is another option to put on the table.
Representative Thiessen.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And just we can get the information back to us, but just two questions. One, you said you how much percentage do you spend on SROs versus spending it on counseling in your districts? What's the percentage of the safe school levy that's used to pay for?
No idea.
And if you don't have, you can get back to me later, or us later, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Would any of you want to venture a comment on that?
Madam Chair Mr. Representative Thiessen, we're looking at each other. We wouldn't know that. I think maybe MDE might through you, FARS, but probably not. They might. They probably wouldn't. We could survey our members, but it would take a while, honestly. It's a good question. Can't answer it.
And the second, Madam Chair, is how much do your school districts, how much are they able to draw down on Medicaid to pay for some of these mental health services as opposed to, and I actually, like, at some point, the department to actually get back to me on that, because they're supposed to have a contract with the under federal law with the Department of Human Services to take care of that, and I haven't heard the I haven't been able to get information back on that, so if the department could get back to me on that, too. But do you have any idea how much, how your schools are accessing Medicaid dollars to help pay for some of these services?
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Thiessen, there are federal reports on that. We had one on our website about the dollars that our schools are using for Medicaid. It's very important. I don't know a percentage of spending on mental health, but you can find the raw dollars for Medicaid reimbursement for third-party services of all kinds.
And again, we don't have to spend that much time now, but we can get that, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. And I see Ms. Gilbert has come down. She may have a comment on that. And please and identify yourself for the
Madam
record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Cloud Public Schools. All schools are accessing Medicaid dollars for doing evaluations for social work services. However, there are very few districts that are actually drawing down the federal dollars to provide the actual therapy services. And that's because we have the child therapeutic system here, and you have to become, not only do you have to follow all the rules for the IEP due process and paperwork, you have to do the second system in place to draw down the dollars. And we have been working with the Department of Human Services to see if there's some other opportunities for schools with appropriately licensed social workers to access the dollars through the outpatient mental health reimbursement system. And in fact, we're having another meeting on Friday to discuss that.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nolan, would you tell me again what you were saying about the $380 cap per kid? Did you want that raised, or did you want the cap removed, or do you have a set amount of money, or I didn't quite understand what your point was.
Mr. Nolan, good question. The chair had refrained from asking how much, but Representative Murphy has asked.
Madam Chair, Representative Mercy, the working group actually recommended to go up to $470. Which would close the gap. But that could just simply continue, as Mr. Strom has indicated here, because the idea was to close this gap. And you can see it did close, this is your handout, did close significantly, but has stopped. So, yes, we would like to see that increase, but also dust off recommendation number 4 from that working group. They had a really solid set of recommendations that has been implemented piecemealy. Even though it's 4 years old, I'd go back and look at that, because it talked about using the lease levy and equalizing that and having that as a pot of money for improvements, so you didn't compete maintenance versus improvement, which is going to, as Osseo said, yes, they can reprioritize, but that's going to be a struggle inside of the district. So do something, please. Obviously, what the chair is recommending is a start. We ask you to come back and look at that in future meetings here yet this session.
Thank you for that clarification.
Representative
Abney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Panel on school safety. None of you mentioned arming teachers.
Mr. Amoroso?
There's a question in there.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, our solicitation does not support the arming of teachers.
Mr. Krumpus?
Madam Chair, members, that is not on our legislative platform either.
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman and Representative Murphy, we have a 28-page platform, and I can tell you no place on any one of those pages does it say arming teachers.
Mr. Nolan?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, unfortunately, we've experienced this in rural Minnesota with Red Lake and Ricori. I had the opportunity after Newtown, when this issue came up, to ask both superintendents, would you consider arming teachers? And they emphatically both said no. It would not have helped in the situation, would have created unsafe situations inside their school. So those are two folks who you could, Scott Staska is still Superintendent Ricori, you could bring him forward if you wanted. We don't have a position on it. I don't believe we would endorse anything like that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions quickly? Otherwise, we are going to recess, and we'll be back in this room at 5 o'clock. Or call of the chair. All right, so the Education Finance Committee will stand in recess until 5 o'clock, or call of the chair in room.